Thank you, Joe. It's appropriate in a meeting on Richard Weaver, and the title of this meeting is taken from, this whole conference is taken from one of Weaver's important books, to remember a member, former member, late member of the Philadelphia Society, Ted Smith III, who did so much to promote our understanding of Weaver. He died shortly after completing a collection for Liberty that Liberty Fund published. And before he could complete his intellectual biography on Weaver, I particularly wish he were here for this panel because his wisdom and knowledge would benefit us all. So, Ted, in your honor. Second minor point, many of the words you hear me say are actually quotations from Richard Weaver, but I am not going to bother to let you know that. I will give Bill a copy of my talk, and you can go back and see for yourself, partly because we're on such a tight time schedule here that if I say quote and unquote, it will use up half of my time. And third, an apology. With my paper, we are flying at about 35,000 feet, and so a broad picture. I think Dutton is going to take us closer to the ground to a couple of works. So with that, I begin with Weaver's first and best-known book, Ideas Have Consequences. In this work, Weaver contrasts Plato's world of stable universals and thus of epistemological, logical, and moral certainty with the morass of decline, decadence, and ethical and epistemological relativism he finds characteristic of the modern West. In his foreword to the paperback edition, written in 1959, a decade after its original publication, Weaver explains that he was attempting a rigorous cause and effect analysis of the decline of belief in standards and values. On the surface of his argument, the chief culprit, or best representative of a change which came over man's conception of reality during the medieval period, is William of Ockham, who propounded the fateful doctrine of nominalism, which denies that universals have a real existence. According to Weaver, this is the point at which, like Macbeth, Western man made an evil decision, which has become the efficient and final cause of other evil decisions. The history of the West from this point on is one of decline, the domino effect on a large scale. Real universals fell first, and thus began a series of intellectual and moral collapses that seem, in Weaver's telling, to be almost totally deterministic in nature. The final result is that for four centuries, every man has been not only his own priest, but his own professor of ethics. And the consequence is an anarchy which threatens even the minimal consensus of value necessary to the political state. The ultimate culprit behind this precipitous decline, however, is not William of Ockham, but is revealed much later and only in passing in Ideas Have Consequences. In the chapter entitled The Spoiled Child Psychology, Weaver states, "The way was prepared for the criterion of comfort and mediocrity when the Middle Ages abandoned the ethic of Plato for that of Aristotle. While Plato and Christianity," also Weaver adds, "argued for pursuing virtue until worldly consequences became a matter of indifference, Aristotle," and Weaver suggests Thomistic Christianity, which is influenced by Aristotle, "took a less transcendent approach. For Aristotle, the virtuous life was an avoidance of extremes, a middle course between contraries considered harmful. Such a doctrine leaves out of account the possibility that there are some virtues which do not become defective through increase, that virtues like courage and generosity may be pursued to an end at which man effaces himself. For Weaver, Aristotle remains a kind of natural historian of the virtues, observing and recording them as he observed techniques of the drama, but not thinking of a spiritual ideal. A life accommodated to this world of and shunning the painful experiences of extremes, including those of virtues, entail what he proposed for his son Nicomachus." I began with Ideas Have Consequences because it provides the intellectual backdrop and foundation for Weaver's Ethics of Rhetoric, published in 1953, and because this initial evaluation of Plato and Aristotle must be seen in order to understand a later modification of Weaver's thought. I will touch on only two chapters in The Ethics of Rhetoric, Edmund Burke and the Argument from Circumstance, and Abraham Lincoln and the Argument from Definition. In these chapters, Weaver asks and offers an answer to this question: what can be inferred from the aspect of any argument or body of arguments about the philosophy of its maker? Weaver maintains that the rhetorical content of the major premise, which the speaker habitually uses, is the key to his primary view of existence. In addition to its role in the logical structure of an argument, the major premise is expressive of values, and a characteristic major premise characterizes the user. Later, Weaver makes an even stronger claim: a man's method of argument is a truer index in his beliefs than his explicit profession of principles. Weaver then identifies three sources of argument. First, the argument from genus, based on the nature of the thing, and he concludes that those who habitually argue from genus are in their personal philosophy idealists. Second, the argument from similitude, which invokes essential correspondences and which expresses belief in the oneness of the world. Speakers who predominantly argue from similitude look towards some final transcendental unity. And third, argument from circumstance, which Weaver asserts is the nearest of all arguments to purest expediency, savors urgency rather than perspicacity, and is the least philosophical of arguments, since theoretically it stops at the level of perception of fact. Because Weaver is generally seen as a Southern apologist, almost everyone who reads these chapters is surprised, and some are offended, that Weaver proceeds to praise Lincoln and criticize Burke. Weaver charges that Burke had a strong addiction to the argument from circumstance, an approach that is, according to Weaver, fatal to conservatism. Weaver turns to Lincoln to find what Burke lacked, and what Lincoln discovered and Burke did not is that political arguments must ultimately be based on genus or definition. Therefore, in The Ethics of Rhetoric, Weaver concludes that Lincoln, rather than Burke, offers a model for the contemporary conservative. In his chapter on Lincoln, Weaver makes the claim that, this is a quote, "The true conservative is one who sees the universe as a paradigm of essences, of which the phenomenology of the world is in sort of continuing approximation, or, to put this in another way," this is still quoting, "he sees it as a set of definitions which are struggling to get themselves defined in the real world." Now, while William F. Buckley at times would quote that first sentence as a valiant effort at characterizing the conservative, I'm not so sure about that. Even if one sees the universe as a paradigm of essences, one of conservative temper might believe that human agency and will is such as to drive a wedge between the eternal eidos and the reality of life on earth. One of Augustinian temper may believe that Adam's sin was so deep as to shape the structure of God's creation. If one reads the next sentence, "the universe is a set of definitions which are struggling to get themselves defined in the real world," through Voeglinian eyes, one might at least consider the possibility that this comes perilously close to an effort aimed at the immanentization of the eschaton. And Voeglin, we all know, was no happier with the idea or vision of a conservative heaven on earth than with a Gnostic one. I will not pursue these possibilities here, but want to turn to another work by Weaver, his last book, Visions of Order, published posthumously in 1964, and suggest that with this work we get a modification in Weaver's approach to the matters under consideration. In his preface to the paperback version of this book, Ted Smith argues that Visions of Order marks a retreat from the pure Platonism of The Ethics of Rhetoric to a more organic view of language and culture and a more explicitly Christian conception of reality. Again, I will focus only on one part of this book, the chapter on the cultural role of rhetoric. Here, Weaver contrasts rhetoric and dialectic as alternative approaches to investigating, understanding, and acting in the world. First, rhetoric. Weaver opens with the claim that rhetoric depends upon history. He continues, "All questions that are susceptible to rhetorical treatment arise out of history and it is to history that the rhetorician turns for his means of persuasion. Let me pause here, look back at my earlier discussion, and ask a question. If rhetoric depends on history, and if it is to history that the rhetorician turns for his means of persuasion, isn't it unavoidable that rhetoric is intimately related to circumstance? Second, dialectic. According to Weaver, dialectics is abstract reasoning upon the basis of propositions. Later, Weaver tells us that dialectic is epistemological and logical. It is concerned with discriminating into categories and knowing definitions. While dialectic is necessary for promoting understanding in the realm of thought, Weaver insists that by its very nature, dialectic does not tell man what he must do. Let me pause here, look back, and ask another question. What is the relationship between the argument from definition and dialectic? Now, Weaver seeks to avoid a confrontation, dialectic versus rhetoric, that would require the acceptance of one and the rejection of the other. Rather, he maintains that states and societies cannot be secure unless there is in the public expression a partnership of dialectic and rhetoric. If, however, we're forced into a corner and had to choose, I lost a page. I think it likely that he would choose rhetoric, not because of the strengths of rhetoric, but because of the great dangers of dialectic. Weaver writes, "Too exclusive reliance upon dialectic is a matter of the most serious consequence because," and these words are emphasized in the original, "dialectic alone in the social realm is subversive." Now, I am not sure that the word daring is one that many readers would use to describe Weaver's thought, or that Weaver himself would appreciate having that word applied to his thought, but he does take a daring turn at this point in his essay to illustrate how one can become too committed to dialectic for his own good and the good of those whom he influences. Weaver examines the trial of Socrates. In this discussion, Weaver appears to be a reluctant prosecutor. He admits that it would be blasphemous for anyone to suggest that the Athenian assembly did not commit a dreadful injustice. Nevertheless, he muses, since the condemnation occurred, there must have been some cause. With these hesitant first steps, Weaver then moves swiftly, arguing that the cause lies deeper than Alcibiades or other of Socrates' students having gone astray, or personal resentment of those embarrassed in conversation by Socrates. According to Weaver, it was not a small cabal that railroaded him, but it was the people of Athens who had a case against Socrates. Weaver reminds us that Socrates was not only one of the greatest ethical teachers of all times, but also the greatest dialectician of his time. The importance of these two aspects of Socrates' practice may be weighed differently from different vantage points. This is a fairly long quote. "We who study him at this remote date are chiefly impressed with the ethical aspect of his teaching, but those who listened to him in Athens may have been more impressed by his method, which was that of dialectic. By turning his great dialectical skill upon persona and institutions, Socrates could well have produced the feeling that he was an enemy of the culture which the Greeks had created. He was, in a sense, of course, the highest expression of it, but the kind of skill he brought to a peak of development needs harmonizing with other things. When a dialectic operates independently of the concrete facts of a situation, it can be destructive. A dialectic which becomes irresponsibly independent shatters the matrix, which provides the base for its operations. In this fact must have lain the real source of the hostility toward Socrates," Weaver concludes. Weaver then provides selections from Plato's Apology and offers a commentary on Socrates' defense. I will highlight three points in Weaver's discussion. First, the way in which Socrates chose to meet the charge was exactly the way to exacerbate the feelings of those whom he had earlier offended. Second, Socrates' argument with Meletus concerning whether Socrates believed in the gods shows in a clear way the weapon that Socrates had wielded against so many of his contemporaries. It is, in fact, a fine example of the dialectical method. First, the establishment of a class, then the drawing out of implications, and finally, the exposure of a contradiction. As far as logic goes, it is undeniably convincing. Yet, after all, this is not the way in which one talks about one's belief in the gods. The very rationality of it suggests some lack of organic feeling. It has about it something of the look of a trap or a trick. Weaver allows that Socrates employed other modes of argument in his defense, but there is in the apology as a whole enough of the clever dialectician of the man who is concerned only with logical inferences to bring to the minds of the audience the side of Socrates that had aroused his enmity. Throughout his career, according to Weaver, Socrates rarely lost an opportunity to sally forth against the speech makers. At the conclusion of his discussion of the trial of Socrates, Weaver offers his own reflection. In truth, it does require an extreme stand to rule out poetry, politics, and rhetorics. The use of a body of poetry in expressing the values of a culture will not be questioned except by one who takes the radical view presented by Plato in Book 3 of the Republic. Whether or not the poets can withstand a frontal assault from Socratic dialectic, Weaver concludes, if they are good poets, they will show reasoning power enough for their poetry and contribute something to the mind which dialectic is incapable, feeling and motion. These elements may also be supplied by rhetoric, Weaver suggests, because rhetoric is designed to move men's feelings in the direction of a goal. In contrast with dialectic, rhetoric is concerned not with abstract individuals, but with men in being, and thus it must be concerned with real or historical situations. At the heart of the rhetoric is the ability of the rhetorician to enter into a solidarity with the audience through tacit agreement with its perception of reality, founded on matters that everyone has, in a sense, participated in. This also contrasts with dialectic, which seems to, and in Socrates' case, this is made clear by Socrates himself, emphasize the distance between the dialectician and his listeners. Weaver concludes from this foregoing discussion that a society cannot live without rhetoric. There are some things in which the group needs to believe, which cannot be demonstrated to everyone rationally. Acceptance of these beliefs is pressed upon us by a kind of moral imperative arising from the group as a whole. But the dialectician is resistant to this pressure, and to put these matters to the test of dialectic alone is to destroy the basis of belief in them and weaken the cohesiveness of society. Here we seem to be at the heart of the matter for Weaver. Quote, the crucial defect of dialectic alone is that it ends in what might be called social agnosticism. Now, what does society do with the social agnostic? It may not know what to do with him, even though his very existence is a kind of satire or aspersion upon its necessity to act. If society is uncomfortable but uncertain what to do, it may isolate him so he can't corrupt the young, or it may leave him alone to pursue his dialectical investigations, perhaps in a university, or if it is a very progressive society, it may give him his own talk show on MSNBC or Comedy Central. Perhaps, however, society may know what to do with him in a very crude and unpleasant form. Again, this is quoting Weaver. It will put him away. Those who have to cope with the passing of reality feel that neutrality is a kind of desertion. In addition to understanding, they expect a rhetoric of action. And Weaver concludes in a chastened manner, I think, we must concede them some claim of this. We all know how the first trial of Socrates ended. He was found guilty. He was sentenced to death. How does the trial of Socrates at the hands of Richard Weaver end? All of the evidence is there. Weaver has the gavel in the air. The charge, interestingly, in Weaver has been transmuted. Socrates is charged with being too much of a dialectician. He can't bring himself to condemn Socrates. He does contemn dialectics, but not Socrates. He says that the indictment against Socrates has not been quashed. He leaves it to another jury and other jurists to resolve the issue. And in my judgment, everyone who has ever read a Platonic dialogue, a Socratic dialogue, or ever heard Socrates' story has received a summons to that jury to finally resolve the issue. Let me conclude very quickly with some puzzles that I have out of the works I've discussed. Had Weaver had the opportunity to revisit Edmund Burke and Abraham Lincoln after his turn from Plato to Aristotle, how would he have rewritten those early chapters from the Ethics of Rhetoric? The key question, of course, is not what would his evaluation of Burke and Lincoln have been, but what would his revised evaluation of the argument from circumstance and the argument from definition be? Lincoln was no Socrates, driven by dialectic alone. As a rhetorician, Lincoln could pluck the mystic chords of memory in ways that touched and moved souls. So I'm not sure Lincoln would have fallen in Weaver's estimation. Weaver himself might have come to express some concerns with the notion of the universe as a set of definitions which are struggling to get themselves defined in the real world, and he might rethink his understanding of conservatism based on that view. He might also have provided an altered evaluation of the strengths and value of the argument from definition alone. Perhaps the later Weaver would have been more sympathetic to argument from circumstance and have seen in Burke intimations of natural law or other signs of transcendence that he had originally missed. From our perspective today, one might conclude that both as rhetoricians and political actors, either Burke or Lincoln would be preferable to any of the alternatives now before us. That comment, of course, is but an invitation to let the argument begin.
Thank you very much.